Liberal government was far from the end of the mandate it had received from the people of Canada in 1963, for some strange reason, almost from the beginning of 1965, the soothsayers on the Hill began to talk about a 1965 election. The rumors ebbed and surged, gaining impetus one day, only to die away the next. But in midsummer, the recurring rumors of election began to seem more substantial. One highly regarded commentator would pontificate that an election was definitely in the cards for the fall of the year. The following day, he would be shot down in flames by another columnist. In late August, the Prime Minister made a Western tour. This was all the pundits needed. Obviously, he was going out to sound Western opinion. It must mean an election. Eventually, the election spirit caught up with even Mr. Pearson, and he began to joke and tease the commentators. But the teasing took on more serious tones, and on his return from the West, he stated that within a week, he would come to a decision about an election and left for a few days at Harrington Lake, the prime ministerial summer home. Suddenly, on Tuesday, September the 8th, the announcement that the prime minister would make a national address that evening. This was what the nation had been waiting for.
I do not think we can follow any steady course. If there are day-to-day uncertainties about the government having a majority in Parliament to get things done. Therefore, I have asked the Governor General to dissolve Parliament now, so that there can be a general election on November the 8th.
Thus began what was called the election that nobody wanted. And within minutes of the Prime Minister's announcement, John Diefenbaker had condemned the decision to call it as unnecessary, inspired by a fear of meeting Parliament after the Dorion inquiry, and constituting a cynical disregard of the rights of Canadians. Throughout the long and frequently bitter campaign, the Prime Minister stressed the fact that he needed a clear majority to govern the country, a point of view that was widely derided by the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition, and which, according to his opponents, was given the lie by the amount of important legislation that his recently dissolved government had been able to pass. It was charge and countercharge. For every argument of the Prime Minister's, Mr. Diefenbaker had an answer. And if it wasn't he, NDP leader Tommy Douglas, Socred Robert Thompson, or creditiste Ray Alcouet put in their oars and, on occasions, made a strong point of their own. In kicking the campaign off, Lester Pearson pointed to the Conservative Party and laughed at their apparent lack of unity.
The current maneuverings inside the Tory Party recall the words of Lewis Carroll in The Hunting of the Snark, words used incidentally this week in a news magazine in a somewhat different context. And these words are, "But the valley grew narrow and narrower still, and the evening got darker and colder, till, merely from nervousness, not from goodwill, they marched along shoulder to shoulder."
John Diefenbaker denied his party was lacking in unity.
"There's a new feeling of unity in this party, and in every part of Canada. Oh, in the old days, they used to have one of those fellows go through the country with a horse, and he used to have a long horse whip, and he'd flip. He could pick off this, that, and the other thing. Finally, one day, he picked off a bee's hive, and he did it well. Somebody said, 'Try out that one. It was a hornet's nest.' He said, 'Oh, no. They're organized.' And I draw the line there. Well, we are organized in unity, and Mr. Pearson didn't know that when he called the election."
Mr. Pearson outlined his reasons for calling the election.
"The primary reason for this election is that today there are major issues and problems facing Canada, and that in dealing with them, the federal government can do the best possible job only if it has the support of a parliamentary majority based on the confidence of Canadians in all parts of the country. For this purpose, I am asking for a clear mandate so that our country can have the leadership and the strength in Ottawa needed to get on with the basic tasks, maintaining our economic expansion, improving social security, providing equal opportunity for all Canadians, in short, to get on with the essential job of building up the new Canada.
Nothing was said about the flag in the election campaigns of 62 and 63. Nothing was said, and action was taken. Nothing was said about policies setting up within this nation associate states. On they go. Unity for Canada, built on twos, two flags, two pension schemes, two types of national organization insofar as Dominion-provincial relations are concerned, and two types of laws, one for the rest of us and the other for banks and bananas and mananas and all that other kosher.
While all this was going on, Tommy Douglas, leader of the New Democratic Party, was stumping the country from coast to coast.
I am confident that we can make a major breakthrough because we are in the mainstream of world thought. Time is on our side. And I promise you that we will put on the toughest, the most effective, and the most aggressive campaign that has ever been put on by our party.
In the days ahead, we will be carrying on some of the most important negotiations the province has in our history. It will be a good thing for Canada to have a strong federal government in Ottawa to speak for Canada in these negotiations. And we propose to do that.
And look at that government as I look at them. Reminds me so much of a cushion on a sofa which bears on its surface the shape of the last person that sat on it.
Taxation and financial problems are looming up. The report of the Tax Structure Committee reallocating financial resources between the provinces and the federal government. Important trade negotiations. Improved social security. Negotiations with the provinces over Medicare. The war on poverty and the fight for equal opportunity. All these things require a strong government in Ottawa.
When Mr. Pearson says, you know, I've launched a war on poverty, I'm impressed. He said, I've appointed Tom Kent as director of the War on Poverty. And that impressed me, too. And they elevated his salary from about $12,000 to $25,000. He won his war on poverty.
We must never become so obsessed with arguments about methods, which will vary from time to time and region to region, that we lose sight of the one thing which distinguishes us from all other parties, namely the goals and objectives of a society which guarantees equality of opportunity for every Canadian. To do that, we must curb the power of the corporate elite, and in a democracy, that means political action. We might as well recognize now that politics has to do with power. And who shall exercise it? The choice that is facing this country is whether political power will be used to preserve the privileges of the economic elite or be used to meet the needs and aspirations of the Canadian people.
October 8th, the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Minnesota Twins were battling it out for the World Series. And October 10th, the deciding game was played. Los Angeles emerged victorious, defeating the Twins 4-3. In Canada, the election campaign continued. Robert Thompson, the leader of the Social Credit Party, was speaking in Red Deer, his home constituency.
I'm quite convinced that Mr. Pearson has
made the greatest blunder of his political career in calling this election. You know, he sent the pollsters around the country to find out how many seats they could win. And one of these private polling organizations came back and told him he could make win 165. And he backed that up with the remarks of some of his campaign and strategy people who even told him he was going to get 6 or 7 seats in the province of Alberta. And I think against his better judgment, he was forced into this election that he didn't want, and I'm convinced practically nobody else in Canada wants either.
We have tackled the most difficult problems. We have made the tough decisions. We have faced up to the necessity for action arriving out of these decisions. And I make bold to say that the record over 2.5 years, almost 2.5 years, is a good one. Universal old age pension, $75. And when we reach 1970, it'll be $75 at 65 years of age. A Canada pension plan, including protection for widows, children, and disabled, making sure that these benefits will be available to all Canadians across the country. A Canada assistance program for those who need help even under the pension scheme that we have. A national labor code, a national flag, which they said couldn't be done, that we wouldn't try to do it.
Who does Mr. Pearson think he's fooling when he says that he needs a majority in order to bring in collective bargaining for civil servants? Who would have voted against collective bargaining for civil servants if he had brought it in? Would he have had any trouble getting the New Democratic Party members to vote with the government to pass this legislation? He would have had no trouble passing this legislation. The thing is that Mr. Pearson didn't have the courage to bring in this kind of legislation. And therefore, the responsibility for not having this legislation passed lies with him, not with the fact that he didn't have a clear majority. As a matter of fact, I strongly suspect that if Mr. Pearson were to be so fortunate and Canada so unfortunate as to have a clear liberal majority, the chances are he'd do even less with a majority than he's done with a minority. Because I think the Liberal Party, as it did for 22 years when it had a majority, would do now what it did then, roll over and go to sleep.
There was a marked feeling, as support for the Conservatives seemed to blossom, that John Diefenbaker was pulling his party up by the bootstraps and that the old campaigner, showman extraordinary, might just have a chance to pull it off. This possibility was particularly marked as the Prime Minister's advisers were keeping him pretty close to home base, limiting his trips outside Ottawa, almost as though they were trying to keep him remote or above the hurly-burly of political campaigning. And it was during this period that a new phrase crept into the political lingo, campaigning by press release. As day after day, pronunciamentos flowed from Parliament Hill over the signature of Lester B. Pearson, Prime Minister. And so, to November the 8th, and the election that nobody wanted ended in the election that nobody won. All over Canada that night, people were glued to their radios, listening as the returns were brought to them instantaneously, and it soon became apparent that Lester Pearson would not get his majority. Before the returns were completely in, the Prime Minister addressed the nation.
It may well be that no party will have a majority in the House of Commons. I think that that is a disappointing result, naturally, because I campaigned, among other things, on the desirability of this country having a government with a majority in the House of Commons. And I think the continuation of a minority government in the House of Commons presents problems both for Parliament and for the country. I have nothing further to say on that matter. My colleagues and I will naturally be assessing the situation in the light of the returns when they are final. Well, they won't be final for a few days because of the service vote, but we will be meeting Wednesday morning at the cabinet, and we'll be assessing the results at that time. And in our assessment, we will be concerned only with one thing. That is what is best for the country.
The leader of the opposition, John Diefenbaker, spoke to the country from his home riding in northern Saskatchewan.
To me, it was something beyond any ordinary campaign. It was Canada, its future, the determination of the course that this nation would take. It was the reaction of the people that I'll always recall, the kindnesses shown to my wife and me throughout. That's what carried me through. That's what upheld my hand. No one can look into the future. That is denied us. But I can say one thing. I have devoted the years of my life, the full span, to this country. That devotion has been repaid over and over again by the fact that Canadians have given to me, in my custody, their hopes and their aspirations.
The final standings after the service vote was counted were Liberals 131, Conservatives 97, NDP 21, Credit East 9, Social Credit 5, Independents 2. Another minority government for Canada. 3 days after the election, Finance Minister Walter Gordon, a slight, mild-mannered man, resigned from the cabinet of Lester Pearson, ostensibly for giving his leader poor advice in calling an election. The resignation, according to the Prime Minister's office, was accepted with regret, for Walter Gordon had been a long-time friend and was often hailed as the spark plug of the new political image of the Pearson cabinet. He was also one of the most controversial members of that same cabinet. After much pressure from the news media, Walter Gordon called a news conference to explain his reason for resigning.
I had been one of those who had been among the strongest advocates of an election. I think that I thought then that it was desirable to have a strong government in Canada. I haven't changed my mind about that a bit. I think that it would have been better to, if the results had been such that some party would have had a majority. I told the Prime Minister at the time that as I felt strongly about this, and as I was the chairman of the campaign committee, that I would feel that if the results didn't produce a majority, that I should resign. Well, I was one of those who thought we'd done a damn good job and that people would want us to continue to do that job, and I didn't agree with those who thought that a minority situation was the one that would ensure that sort of thing.
And on November 27th in Toronto, the Hamilton Tiger Cats, in a game with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, took the Grey Cup Classic again for the East. The score was 22-16. Ottawa then became quiet. The press gallery emptied as reporters journeyed home for the Christmas holidays. Only a few typewriters were heard clacking away as the ones who remained behind went on keeping the nation informed as to the events on Parliament Hill. New Year's Eve in the House of Commons, a time for reflection, a time to hear the echoes of speeches made by Canada's great men, Macdonald, Laurier, Cartier. The echoes of another famous speech were heard that night in the Commons. The words of Governor General Vanier were heard again, the words he spoke when the flag was raised at the beginning of 1965.
I appeal to all Canadians to set aside pettiness, selfishness, and intolerance where these may exist, and to cultivate a spirit of brotherhood and mutual confidence. I hope and pray that Canadians will in this way give an example of fraternal coexistence, and that our flag will symbolize to each of us and to the world the unity of purpose and high resolve to which destiny beckons us.